Welcome back to the Deep Dive. Today, we're going to be diving into a Supreme Court case that's been making some waves. Sackett v. EPA.
Oh yeah, this one's a biggie.
It is. It's got wetlands, property rights, and a couple from Idaho who ended up in a legal battle that went all the way to the Supreme Court. Twice.
Wow, twice.
Yeah. And get this, the court ruled 9-0, but it seems like everyone has a different interpretation of what the ruling actually means.
I can see how that happened, especially with a case this complex. A lot of nuance to unpack there.
Absolutely. It's fascinating. Mm. And to help us unpack all of it, we've got an expert who's been following this case closely.
Well, thanks for having me. I'm excited to dig into this.
So where do we even begin with a case like this? What makes Sackett v. EPA so unique?
Well, I think the really interesting thing about Sackett is that it exposes just how unclear and complex the Clean Water Act can be, especially when you're trying to figure out what exactly falls under its jurisdiction.
You're talking about WUTS, right? The Waters of the United States.
Exactly.
The Clean Water Act, or CWA, as it's often called, it's a pretty hefty piece of legislation. For our listeners who might need a refresher, could you give us a quick rundown of what the CWA is all about?
Sure. So the CWA was passed back in 72. It's a landmark piece of environmental legislation, and its goal is to restore and maintain the integrity of the nation's waters.
By integrity, you mean like the chemical, physical, and biological?
Yeah, all of that. The CWA gives the EPA the authority to regulate pollution and to set those water quality standards. It's been hugely important in cleaning up our rivers, lakes, and streams, but there's always been a lot of debate and litigation surrounding it, especially when it comes to how far its authority actually reaches.
And that's exactly where the Sackett case comes into play. So let's talk about the Sacketts themselves. We have a couple who bought a piece of property, seemed like a pretty ordinary piece of land, near Priest Lake in Idaho.
Beautiful area.
They paid $23,000, got their permits, and started building their dream home.
Sounds like the American dream, right?
It does. But then everything comes to a screeching halt when the EPA shows up.
Yeah, that's where things get interesting. The EPA steps in and says, hold on, this property has protected wetlands and you need a special permit to build here.
So they ordered them to stop construction.
Not only did they order them to stop, but they also threatened the Sacketts with some serious fines, up to $40,000 each day.
$40,000 per day?
Per day.
Wow. Talk about a nightmare scenario. So what was it about their land that the EPA was so concerned about?
It all comes down to, like we were saying, how Waters of the United States, or WUTS, is defined. The Clean Water Act gives the EPA power over WUTS, but the term navigable waters is pretty open to interpretation.
So it's one of those I know it when I see it kind of things.
Yeah, pretty much. And that's where the conflict comes in.
Wow.
The EPA has the power to determine what falls under their jurisdiction. Now, in the Sacketts case, their property wasn't right on the lake, but the EPA argued that it was connected to Priest Lake through the system of ditches and a creek, making it part of WUTS.
So even though it wasn't directly on the lake, the EPA considered it connected. Seems like a bit of a stretch.
Right, and that's what the Sacketts thought too. Which brings us to their first trip to the Supreme Court Sackett Thirst, back in 2012. This case was about whether they even had the right to challenge the EPA's decision in court.
And the court decided.
The court ruled unanimously in favor of the Sacketts, saying they did have the right to challenge the EPA.
Okay, but that still didn't answer the underlying question, did it? Like, whether their property actually fell under the Clean Water Act.
Nope, that question remained. And that's what eventually brought us to Sackett the Second.
Round two.
And this time it wasn't just about the Sacketts. It was about trying to clarify this whole WUTS mess. There was this earlier Supreme Court case, Rapanos, that actually created two different tests for figuring out what counts as WUTS. And that led to a ton of confusion and conflicting rulings in the lower courts.
Yeah, Rapanos was a bit of a head scratcher. Can you remind us what those two tests were?
So in Rapanos, you had Justice Scalia pushing for the continuous surface connection test. He was saying that a wetland should only be considered WUTS if there's a clear, unbroken connection to a navigable waterway. Like, imagine a garden hose. The water's got to flow directly from the wetland to that larger body of water. No breaks.
Okay, makes sense. A nice visual. What was the other test?
Okay, so then you have Justice Kennedy, in his concurring opinion, proposing the significant nexus test. He said, even if a wetland isn't directly connected to a navigable water, it could still be protected if it has a big impact on the health of that water.
I see. So even if you can't see a direct connection, if that wetland could affect the water quality downstream, it should fall under the EPA's jurisdiction, more about the ecological impact, even without a clear visual connection.
Exactly. And for years, lower courts were mostly siding with Kennedy's broader, significant nexus test.
Giving the EPA a lot of leeway.
A lot of leeway. But then comes second to second. And the Supreme Court seems to slam the brakes on that approach. They go with Scalia's continuous surface connection test. So if it's not directly connected, it's not DOLE-US.
Case closed, right.
Well, that's where things get tricky. Remember all those concurring opinions? It's like they all agreed on the verdict, but took very different roads to get there.
Oh, boy, that doesn't sound straightforward at all.
Not really. And that's what makes Sackett the Second so intriguing. And that's where we'll pick things up in part two of our deep dive. You know what's really interesting about Sackett the Second? It's that even though the decision was 9-0, the justices couldn't agree on why.
Uh-huh. So it's like they all ended up at the same destination, but took completely different routes to get there.
Yeah, that's a good way to put it. We have these four concurring opinions, and each one has a different take on how we should interpret the Clean Water Act and what the ruling means for wetland regulation going forward.
Oh boy, this is where I start to get lost.
Yeah.
So we have a 9-year decision, everyone agrees, but they can't agree on why they agree.
Exactly. And those different opinions tell us a lot.
Well, let's try to break down those concurring opinions then. We'll start with Justice Kavanaugh. He sided with the liberal justices and seemed a little hesitant to limit the EPA's power.
Right. Kavanaugh agreed that the Sackett's wetlands didn't pass the continuous surface connection test, but he was worried that using this test could mean we accidentally exclude wetlands that are separated from navigable waters by things like berms or levees, or even just a tiny strip of land.
He's making a point about those wetlands that might be ecologically connected, but not visually connected, right?
Exactly. He's saying even if there isn't a direct surface connection, those wetlands could still have a big impact on the health of downstream waters. So he's pushing for a more nuanced approach, acknowledging that things aren't always so black and white in the real world.
Makes sense. So Kavanaugh is urging caution, making sure we don't go too far in limiting the EPA. Then we have Justice Thomas, who went in a whole other direction, bringing the Commerce Clause into the mix, no less.
Yeah, Thomas went deep on this one. His concurrence is all about originalism. He argues that the Clean Water Act's authority comes from Congress's power to regulate interstate commerce. And historically, that power was focused on keeping waterways navigable.
So he's saying the CWA's expansion to include water quality in ecosystems is straying from its original intent.
Pretty much. For Thomas, it should all be about navigation and commerce, not about those broader ecological concerns.
Okay, so we've got Kavanaugh on one side saying, let's be careful not to exclude important wetlands, and Thomas on the other side saying, let's stick to what the CWA was originally meant for. Seems like two totally different philosophies at play here.
And that's what makes this case so fascinating. It highlights these fundamental disagreements within the court. And honestly, those disagreements reflect broader societal debates about the government's role, environmental protection, property rights, the whole shebang.
It's a lot to unpack, for sure. Okay, so we have a clear ruling, but the reasons behind it are anything but clear. Practically speaking, what does this all mean? Does it mean landowners can now just ignore environmental regulations?
That's the big question, isn't it? The Sackett decision definitely narrows the scope of the Clean Water Act and the EPA's authority, but those concurring opinions show us there's still a lot of gray area and room for debate.
So basically, get ready for more litigation. This could be a field day for environmental lawyers.
Oh, absolutely. You can bet there'll be a lot of legal back and forth over which wetlands are now exempt from federal protection. The EPA will have to revise its regulations to reflect that new continuous surface connection test, and I guarantee there'll be challenges and lawsuits every step of the way.
And what about the states? Where do they fit into all of this? Could this shift more power back to the states when it comes to regulating wetlands?
Absolutely. We could see a patchwork of regulations emerge, with some states taking a more hands-off approach and others keeping stricter protections in place.
So it's not just a legal battle. It's a potential power shift between federal and state authority when it comes to the environment. This just keeps getting more and more complex.
That's the thing about environmental law. It's never simple. And speaking of complexity, we can't forget about the impact all of this will have on environmental protection.
Right. We can't lose sight of the big picture here. We've talked about how important wetlands are for filtering pollutants, preventing flooding, and providing habitat. If we're now excluding more and more wetlands from protection under the Clean Water Act, what does that mean for the overall health of our water resources? Could we see more pollution, more habitat loss, even more flooding?
Those are all very valid concerns and ones that environmental groups are raising right now. The potential for increased pollution and habitat loss is definitely real, but it's not necessarily all doom and gloom. There are things we can do to try and mitigate these impacts.
So there's still hope. It's not the end of the road for wetland protection. What can we do? What are some of those things that could help?
Well, for one, as we mentioned, states can step up and strengthen their own wetland protection laws. We're already seeing this in some places like California, which has a really strong program that goes beyond the federal requirements.
So California is leading the charge. That's interesting. What about states that maybe aren't as proactive? What happens to the wetlands in those areas?
That's where local communities, conservation organizations, and even individual landowners can make a big difference. There are all sorts of voluntary programs and initiatives that encourage wetland restoration and conservation. And those efforts might become even more important now with the Sackett decision limiting the EPA's authority.
So it's not just about top-down regulation, it's about bottom-up action too.
Exactly. It's about recognizing the value of these ecosystems and taking ownership of their protection.
So we've talked about the legal intricacies of the Sackett case, the different perspectives of the justices, and the potential implications for landowners, developers, and the environment itself. It's a lot to take in.
It is. And to really grasp what this means for the future of wetlands, we need to delve deeper into the consequences for all those players we just mentioned. And that's what we'll do in the final part of our deep dive.
All right, we're back for the final part of our Sackett v. EPA deep dive. We've gone through the legal arguments, those concurring opinions, and now we're getting to the real-world impacts. What's this ruling going to mean for landowners, developers, and, well, wetlands themselves?
Well, Sackett's definitely shaken things up in the legal world and the environmental world. It's a big shift, that's for sure, and it's going to have consequences all across the country.
Let's start with those landowners. If I own some land and I find a soggy spot that, you know, might be a wetland, what does this ruling mean for me? Can I just, like, grab my bulldozer and start building?
Whoa, hold on there. Not quite that simple. Even though the Sackett decision does limit what the EPA can do, it doesn't mean landowners can just do whatever they want with wetlands. Don't forget about all those state laws. Lots of states have their own rules about wetlands, their own permitting processes, and some of those go even further than the federal requirements.
So it's not a free pass for everyone. Landowners still have to figure out what their state allows, right? But wouldn't that be confusing? Trying to figure out all the federal and state rules, it seems like it'd be easy to mess up or accidentally break a rule.
Oh, it definitely adds to the complexity. That's why it's super important for anyone who owns land to get legal advice if they're not sure about wetlands. Environmental lawyers are going to be busy helping people navigate all these rules.
Okay, so landowners need to be careful. What about developers? Does this make it easier for them to get permits and build in areas that used to be off limits? Are we going to see a building boom on former wetlands?
It's definitely possible, because now that the definition of waters of the United States is narrower, it could open up more land for development. But again, it's not like developers can just ignore everything. They've still got to deal with those state and local regulations, and there might be pushback from environmental groups and people who live in the area.
So maybe it makes getting permits easier in some places, but it also creates a lot of uncertainty. It sounds like we're in uncharted territory, and nobody's quite sure what the rules are anymore.
And that's exactly where those concurring opinions come back in. They highlight the different ways people think about balancing property rights with protecting the environment. And these debates aren't going away. They're just going to move to different battlegrounds, state legislatures, local zoning boards, and, of course, the courts.
Okay, let's zoom out and look at the big picture, the environment. We talk about how important wetlands are. They clean the water, stop floods, and provide habitats. If fewer wetlands are protected by the Clean Water Act, could we see more pollution, more habitat loss, even more flooding?
Those are definitely big worries, and environmental groups are raising those concerns right now. There's a real risk of increased pollution and losing habitats. But it's not all doom and gloom. There are things we can do to try and minimize the damage.
So it's not a lost cause. There's still hope for wetlands. What can be done? What are some steps we can take?
Well, like we talked about, states can make their own wetland protection laws stronger. We're seeing that already. California, for example, they have a really solid wetland protection program that goes way beyond what the federal government requires. And other states might follow their lead, stepping in to cover the gaps left by the Sackett decision.
So it's like a game of environmental federalism, with states taking a bigger role. What about states that aren't so quick to act, What about the wetlands in those places?
That's where local communities, conservation groups, and even individual people who own land can have a huge impact. There are all sorts of voluntary programs that encourage restoring and conserving wetlands. And these programs might become even more important now that the EPA's power is more limited.
So it's not just about laws and regulations, it's about people understanding the value of wetlands and taking care of them.
Exactly. It's about recognizing how important these ecosystems are and being good stewards of the environment.
Well, we've explored a lot with this Sackett v. EPA deep dive. It's clear this isn't just some legal case. It's about values, about finding a balance between what individuals want and protecting our environment, and about the power the courts have to shape the world around us.
It definitely reminds us that environmental law isn't always black and white. It's about figuring out really complicated and sometimes controversial issues, finding solutions that work for everyone, and always adapting to new challenges and what science tells us.
And that's a great point for our listeners to take away. Sackett v. EPA is just one part of a much bigger story about how we manage our environment, how we see ourselves in relation to nature, and what kind of future we want. It's a story that's still being written, and we all have a part in writing it.
Couldn't have said it better myself. What happens to our wetlands and to our planet as a whole depends on what we do and if we're willing to get involved in these important, complex issues.
Huge thanks to our expert for helping us navigate all of this. And to our listeners, thanks for joining us for the deep dive. We'll catch you next time for another deep dive into something that'll make you think, learn, and maybe even see the world a little differently. Until then, keep exploring, keep asking questions, and keep diving deep.